coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Everyone, this is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We are on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. On this program, we seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we are talking to Andrea Douglas and Jelaine Schmidt about their upcoming pilgrimage to the new Legacy Museum and National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. They'll be bringing soil from the spot in Albemarle County where John Henry James was lynched to memorialize his murder. The museum will then be shipping a 300-pound steel marker to be placed in Charlottesville's Justice Park. We'll explore what it means to create the public space here in Charlottesville for this memorial. And we have Matthew Burtner, an Alaskan-born composer and sound artist conveying social, spiritual, and political themes using technology and the environment. He's made music from snow, ice, fog, cold, wind, and lava. His experience growing up in Alaska deeply informs his work. Through his many projects, Burtner expresses his activism on behalf of the environment. And if you like the sounds of these three, and who wouldn't, we've spoken to over 100 talented, scholarly, fascinating guests like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. Speaking of fascinating people, is my friend Nancy Lawrence there in New York City?
I'm here, Ellen. I'm hobnobbing already. I'm up for expanding our incredible list, our guest list. Another 200. I think, you know, yeah. Obviously we can't have too many of these amazing people. As you said, very excellent lineup today, as you already
yes.
detailed.
And I wanted to tell you that I pardon you for everything you've ever done.
Yeah.
In an abuse of my own power.
I know what?
In an abuse of my own power that no one could foresee. That's what I'm
Well, you have, it's true. I realized once I donated that, wrote that check to you, I was hoping that you would, you know, allow a clean slate and allow me to walk free from, it's quite incredible. Of course, nothing surprises me anymore, but I mean, he pled, you know, D'Souza pled guilty. He wasn't even right. in jail, wasn't looking for a pardon.
Yes.
We're just teaching all these horrible lessons to our children, which I don't have, but I mean, it's terrible.
Hopefully we're going to rectify that today on the show, but I wanted to mention this really great video piece. This is related to this topic from the Washington Post Global Opinions. The editor, Karen Atiyah, she was talking about a Sudanese billionaire. I don't know if you know this, Mo Ibrahim. He started the Mo Ibrahim Fund to pay African leaders who, A, changed their country for the better, and then, B, stepped down at the end of their democratically elected terms. And they pay $5 million over 10 years, then $200,000 per year for life. So I say let's pay Trump to leave.
Totally. You know, it's so obvious. I have no degrees in diplomacy. It is so obvious how to work this guy. That's a great thing that you mentioned. I don't mean to step on it, but you're just you're reminding me why the EU, Canada, and Mexico don't punish America. Punish that guy. If you want him to take the tariffs off, give him, I don't know, give him something the way the Qataris are. And who else is, the Chinese gave Ivanka trademarks. I mean, just give him something. Give him, a burger place, and they'll take the steel and aluminum tariffs off.
Yeah, I think we have to fake a movie set or something. It's going to have to be very elaborate.
Right. Yeah. It's got to be a celebrity. Is that what? Yeah. Someone. It doesn't take anything. Did you see the smile on his face when he got that letter from Kim Jong-un, the whatever the letter was? It came in this huge envelope. He looked like he won the Publisher's Clearinghouse. I mean, it was just a letter.
So I wanted to talk about an event, and feel free to chime in. But we have a new friend. He was a friend of the show, I should say, Stephen Thomas. He's a champion of racial justice who was on a couple of weeks ago. He's very active in his community in Harrisonburg as well as here in Charlottesville. So Tuesday, June 5th at 7 in that town, the Northeast Neighborhood Association of Harrisonburg is hosting a community-wide discussion envisioning a truth and reconciliation commission and process with the special guest, social rights activist Dr. Fania Davis. She is the director at Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth.
Yeah, that is going to be good.
And then June 8th, I wanted to plug our guest we're going to hear from later, Matthew Burtner. We're going to hear about a concert that he's giving later. I'm excited to hear about that. So we have an amazing show today, Nancy.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, as I turned the page.
I caught wind of it when you started speaking a few minutes ago.
I thought
I'd stick around to the end.
I'm so glad that I'm so happy to hear that. Our first guests are Andrea Douglas and Jelaine Schmidt. They are organizing and making a pilgrimage to the New Legacy Museum and National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. They'll bring soil from the spot in Albemarle County where John Henry James was lynched and memorialize his murder. Then the museum is going to be shipping this 300-pound steel marker to be placed in Charlottesville's Justice Park. We're going to discuss all that and what it means to create a public space here in Charlottesville for this memorial. Andrea Douglas is the executive director of the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. Jelaine Schmidt is a religious studies professor at the University of Virginia. Jelaine, welcome back. And Andrea, welcome.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us how first this trip came about and how the idea to memorialize John Henry James's lynching came about.
Well, I was a member of the Blue Ribbon Commission that was convened in 2016. And one of the recommendations that was made by the Blue Ribbon Commission, in particular, a member of that commission named Frank Dukes, who was aware of the EJI project, was in fact to recover the lynching monument and bring it back to Charlottesville. When the commission made its report, there was a lot of conversation about statues, but there was this conversation where council did agree that we should go ahead with this portion of the recommendation. And it was a consequence of Dr. Schmidt, Jelaine, who pursued it and brought it back to council and made it, brought it back to the top of the list, as it were, and out of obscurity, I would say, because it really was one of these conditions or recommendations that was buried in the other parts of the dialogue. So through the Blue Ribbon recommendation, through Dr. Schmidt's efforts to cause council to consider moving, acting on this, given that we weren't going to know what the outcomes for the Confederate statues were going to be, we sort of were charged by city council to take on the project. So that's how it came to be.
And Andrea, did the events of last year push your wanting to memorialize John Henry James to the forefront, or was it inevitable that this was going to happen around now?
Well, I think in a short answer, yes. But in the longer answer, you know, I'm an art historian who is very much aware of objects in public spaces. And when you think about Charlottesville's objects and what those are, the length of time between when a statue of any permanence has been placed in the city to where we are, it's over 90 years, right? And these particular statues in and of themselves are problematic. I'm also part of a project to create a large monument to Vinegar Hill, which would have been the next iteration of a permanent statue. It has been commissioned by an artist named Melvin Edwards, who is one of the leading, most known African-American artists who create these kinds of monumental objects. Many of them placed in sites that are that recognize events that have occurred in African American history. So, in one way or another, we were already starting to think about what permanent objects in Charlottesville's public spaces look like. And so, these statues, you know, it's a Confederate monument statue, but it's also about what are the kinds of values that can be articulated by objects in public spaces. And that's one of the things that I've always thought about. And I think that there are a number of us who continue to think about this. So I think, you know, when the stars align, they certainly do align.
If I could just jump in here now as well to answer your question about the timeline for getting these lynching memorials with respect to what transpired last summer with the Summer of Hate white supremacist rallies. Directly after the murder of Heather Heyer on August the 12th, the city council voted to shroud our Confederate monuments in mourning shrouds, and this action was challenged by the same plaintiffs who were attempting to litigate the case for keeping the monuments in town. The plaintiffs contended that this shrouding, you know, amounted to, you know, kind of depriving the public of the pleasure of viewing these statues, and ultimately the judge agreed, and the city was forced earlier this spring in March to remove those shrouds that had stood for some, you know, 6 months or so on the statues. So in light of that, some constituents brought to council the need to really move ahead on the lynching memorial as a way to have a sort of public representation in our parks, which challenges the current monuments to white supremacy there. So that did kind of bring this up to the fore again this spring, you know, after the unshrouding of the Confederate monuments.
Yeah, thank you, Jelaine. And what are the legalities of doing this? Did you have to talk with the city, the county, for any of this?
Well, you know, this is something that the city is looking at, you know, in terms of placement. The city, some months ago already, put out a request for proposals for a redesign of the public parks, and this was something that was in the works anyway. Part of the request for proposals that was publicized there included placement of this lynching memorial within the proposed submission redesigns.
And I know I had heard that, you know, the people that wanted to keep the statue said you can't remove it, but maybe you could put something else there. So that falls right in line with what they're saying is okay. Is that your understanding?
Well, I mean,
not that it matters.
Right. I mean, many of these plaintiffs and their supporters who advocate keeping the statues, often made the case that why not be additive rather than subtract? And so, well, here's a idea that's certainly additive that would serve to recontextualize these monuments to white supremacy by showing precisely what white supremacy is capable of, which is that it's lethal. I mean, we saw that last summer. It's always been that way. I mean, the case of John Henry James in 1898 demonstrates this. And it's not an accident, you know, that the proposal to place this lynching memorial would be adjacent to the courthouse. That is, this was an abrogation of the rule of law within the jurisdiction of the Court of Albemarle that happened.
I was just going to ask, what is the story of John Henry James?
Well, the story goes that on July 11th, 1898, a woman, Mrs. Hottep, what was her first name?
Julia
Hottep, a white woman, was accosted outside of her gate. And allegedly, in the first iteration of the story, she did not see her assailant, but described him as a large black man. And also indicated that she was hit on the head and lost consciousness. Another iteration of the story is that she fought him off and scratched his face to the point where she would have skin under his nails. He was apprehended, brought to jail in Charlottesville, and because of fear of mob action, he was removed from the jail in Charlottesville and taken to Staunton, which is just, I would say, about 20-30 miles out west of Charlottesville. It is on the way back from Staunton on the train, the slow train on the way back, that a mob apprehends the train. The description of it is that the mob got on the train at the platform, both in the rear and the front. They were not, their faces were not covered. They were carrying weapons, and they removed John Henry James from the train. And the account is fairly precise. You know, he was taken from the train, carried 40 yards away to a locust tree where he was hung. He was allowed to pray for 20 minutes. Then he was riddled with bullets and hung from the tree. And while he was hanging there over several hours, a crowd of about 100 to 150 people were witness to this, and they removed articles of his clothing and his body. And all of this occurred on July 12th, which is the reason why part of the end goal for us is to arrive in Montgomery on July 12th to commemorate the 120th anniversary of this occurrence. Mm-hmm. Jelaine, did I leave anything out?
That's right. Well, I think it's important to say that this is a lynching case, which was sadly all too typical, which was that, of course, the accused was not allowed to stand trial. And also there in the press at that time, there were varying accounts, which, as you read them chronologically, seem to be embellished with each account, like a game of telephone. And to the point that, even though James was described as having been scratched such that his skin was scratched off his face when he was apprehended the next day, there's no reports, no description of him having any wounds. And indeed, one of the newspaper accounts said there was considerable doubt, as to whether or not this was indeed the assailant. Yet, the front page of the Daily Progress reported that, quote, the people of Charlottesville heartily approved of the lynching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to your point, the Equal Justice Initiative, who is the overarching organization for the museum and the memorial, document that 4,400 black men and women were the victims of domestic racial terrorism between 1877 and 1950. And they document lots of that, according to one, maybe it was Brian Stevenson, who is the director of EJI, said that that's just the tip of the iceberg. And those organizations in the museum and the memorial, I would suggest going to that website. They're really all-encompassing, great websites to prepare you and encourage you to go to Montgomery to see the work that they're doing there.
Yeah, and to that point too. I mean, one of the things that strike me about this story in relationship to the history of lynching, it's just the degree of violence. You know, it is not uncommon to first be riddled with bullets and then hung and then the body be dismembered. One of the best known cases is a lynching that occurs in Mississippi, where one of the bodies are burnt, charred beyond recognition. So the notion of violence and the way violence creates terror, that is what is at issue here. And lots of people will make the argument, well, it wasn't just blacks who were lynched, right? But the idea of lynching and what its purpose was really about terror, and it's about terrorism. And how the question becomes, how do we carry those kinds of notions into our contemporary moment? And how do we understand that occurrence in 1898 in relationship to what happens today? And I think those are points that ought not to be missed in that story.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. We're going to go to a break right now. We'll be right back with Andrea Douglas, Jelaine Schmidt, about their pilgrimage to Montgomery, Alabama. We're going to talk about just that when we come right back. Don't go away. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Andrea Douglas, Jelaine Schmidt. Before the break, we were talking about why this is important for this city and really, in fact, the country. Could you address that, this pilgrimage?
Yes. Lynching created a refugee crisis for black Americans coming from the rural South to the urban North in order to escape the systemic violence that lynching part of the lynching crisis. In our own community of Charlottesville, the majority of the population prior to 1890 was African American. There's a steady decline in the population, as there is in many communities across the South from the 1890s through the 1920s and beyond, as black people are escaping violence. And this gets to the point of how the treatment of black and brown bodies in public spaces, and we're seeing even today, you know, with the many, many cases of police killings of unarmed black civilians or blacks being summarily removed from what are supposed to be public spaces. In our own community of Charlottesville, the disproportionate stop and frisk rate of black and brown people, you know, by the police. And so this is an opportunity to reflect upon how the state-sanctioned violence and also kind of vigilantism, which was what this lynching was, have played a role in terrorizing black communities and setting up systems that still operate to this day, which are detrimental to black lives.
You know, I know that 52% of the population during the Civil War was black, and just knowing for so long that such a one-sided conversation, so far as calling it the lost cause, there's just no, it's all glorification of the Confederacy. There's nothing about the opposite, minimizing the role of slavery. And I'm just, you know, I'm wondering, this pilgrimage you're doing, you're bringing his soil, John Henry James's soil, soil from his site, rather, down there. And what are you bringing? What are you bringing back to Charlottesville?
Well, and before I answer that question, I also want to add, not only are we bringing the soil, but we're bringing 110 people from Charlottesville. So there is this kind of really interesting metaphor that's being accomplished here as well. 110 people across income range, across age range, gender range, and one of the things that we've understood over the course of the last year is how much people don't know about this history. How much that, even when we're talking about these lost cause narratives, that when we were sitting there last year listening to people talking about heritage versus history, this idea that these Confederate statues are part of heritage and the unwillingness to accept their role in history and how they were placed in this these public squares as signifiers of a kind of social supremacy. And the one of the arguments I make about this, in terms of, again, just looking at the very objectness of the object, when these things are placed in 1924, we've already moved past the discussion of statues on pedestals. We're in the middle of modernism. These things are specific to their purpose and their place. And so the metaphor of bringing bodies, bringing soil to this site, I think is one that we need to also bring to light. And it is hopefully, at the end of the day, a set of processes and practices that bring this community and others who then do something along the same lines of causing these objects to be in their community as a way of bringing this history to light in a very, very concrete and non-abstract way.
Mm-hmm. And before you get to what the marker is, what I always find interesting is when those monuments were placed, they were at times when legislation was going to the left. Like, I think it was Brown versus Board of Education, or that was a different sort. There were different markers at that time for that, or statues for that. So that is, I mean, that really illustrates what you're trying to say.
Yeah, they're responsive. Without question, they're responsive. But it's how do you then articulate You know, what are, number one, what are our values today? Number two, what is the distinction between the values we hold today and the values that cause those objects to be in place? And how do you then institutionalize a set of values? And so, you know, the marker in and of itself that will be descriptive of lynching, the marker that also describes the actual violent action, and then the object that eventually will stand in its place. It is a body, right? It's 6 feet tall.
Can you describe what it is?
It's a large. It's 300 pounds, 6 foot tall. How deep is it? It's substantial.
1 foot by 2 foot. Yeah, it's almost the size of a coffin, if you will. You know, and it's very deliberately crafted this way by the EJI. They have these memorial modules. They're called suspended, you know, from the ceiling.
Are they the same that we've seen?
Yes, okay. Yes, they are. Right. And so there are twin modules, one that will stay there at EJI, hanging, as it were, almost, to look like a lynched body. And then the other, which will go home to the individual community to memorialize their specific lynching.
That's a brilliant idea.
And you're also... On your way down to Alabama, you're stopping in certain specific places. Can you tell us where you're going along the way?
Yes. The first day is July the 8th, which is the one-year anniversary of the Ku Klux Klan rally in our town. And the first two stops are in Appomattox and Danville, Virginia, which are kind of Civil War sites of the surrender of Lee at Appomattox Courthouse. In the case of Appomattox, the last Confederate cabinet meeting in Danville, and then also learning in Danville about the history of civil rights there with their own Bloody Monday, it was called, I believe, in 1963 when MLK came to visit there. So we'll be stopping in various sites and going to Greensboro, visiting the Woolworth counter there at their museum, hearing from Greensboro members of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that they held in response to the Klan killings of five black activists in 1979. And so on and so on through various communities, Charlotte, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, where we will view the permanent exhibit of lynching photography, which is there in a museum. And we'll, of course, visit the MLK Center in Atlanta, and then on to Birmingham to visit the Southern Poverty Law Center there and the Birmingham Bus Museum, and then finally in Montgomery, Alabama, arriving at the EJI Memorial on July the 12th, which is the 120th anniversary of the lynching of Mr. James.
And are you still taking people if they want to sign up at Jeff School?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So I know the website is jeffschoolheritagecenter.org, and if you go to events, you can look for Memorial Lynching at the Left.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Good. And so what is the goal in our... We have about 5 minutes, 4 minutes left or so. What is the goal that... What would you like to see, and what would you like to see come out of this?
Well, I mean, going back to the original charge of the Blue Ribbon Commission, it was really about re-articulating the racial history of Charlottesville in its public spaces. And as I said, what we have learned, and certainly being the African-American Heritage Center has an opportunity to talk to a wide swath of people, and we've spent a year being the site of many conversations around racial reconciliation, around people trying to grapple with their concept of Charlottesville versus certain truths. And so over the course of the process, there's an essay contest that we're doing with high school students to get them thinking about the Jim Crow period. We are working with teachers to sort of give them the kind of information that will allow them to teach in the classroom over the fall. And then we're also creating a community set of conversations that actually begins on July 7th after we've collected the soil. We'll be showing a film, a recent film by Hannah Ayers and Lance Her husband, Lance, whose last name I just forgot.
An outrage.
I'm sorry, Lance. that is about lynching. So that's one of our first instances where we'll really have a community-engaged conversation. And at the end of the year, we hope that we will have brought Charlottesville along, brought them to a place of being almost on the same page, where everyone is working with the same set of facts, where we have gone through the dialogue so that at the end of it, this object and the conversation can really, as I say, have a tangible location in our community.
It's Lance. Hold on a second. Lance Warren.
Thank you.
Okay.
And part of this process for planning this pilgrimage event has been to, first of all, to kind of promote broader public knowledge of the facts of our history that have remained buried for so long. And then secondly, in doing so, to build a constituency of a range of representatives of different groups throughout the city, some of whom will be sending members on this pilgrimage delegation. And then, as Andrea said, promoting future events that continue to promote knowledge of our common history to a broader point. And so this process has been really good in terms of bringing different groups together. We have groups from the clergy, from the philanthropic community, from the University of Virginia, activists, just lots of different folks that are coming together in the planning process for this pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I saw that you actually, of the two, I think there are two buses, well, you know best the plan, but mm-hmm. I saw that there were 33, you're saving like 33 seats for Charlottesville high school students to make sure that students and teachers are able to go as well. Is that
absolutely, and that's a really important point to help to promote curricular change, to give teachers the tools that they need for teaching students and to expose students to these ideas. Also along on the trip will be Mayor Nakia Walker, as has indicated that she wants to come. Susan Breaux, the mother of slain anti-racist activist Heather Heyer, will be along. Several members of the Blue Ribbon Commission that kind of spearheaded this discussion in 2016, and lots of other folks. And yes, a swath of members of the community, and we have reserved seats and are receiving donations to support full travel scholarships for those who with demonstrated financial need.
So again, if you want to go, and I think there, like you said, there's support for those people who, if you think you can't afford it, there probably will be help. Go to jeffschoolheritagecenter.org, go to events, look for Memorial Lynching. Also, we're going to post all this information on the website, 947wpvc.org. You can also go to our Bitly website. It's the same, actually, Bitly AOS Talk. So do you want to leave us with a short anything? Final word? And
well, I think if there is anything that I can say that it's a final word on, it's that one of the things that drives me in all of that we do, and I think Jelaine will agree, it's that for so long we have not had a very clear history of American history. And it's because I believe that we have placed history as a kind of elitist action in some regard, in our language of our politicians, that we are far from as informed about those issues that are so very impactful in our lives. And for me, this is about truth-telling. This is about coming to grips and with American history in a way that is not about the meta-narrative of the great advancement of great white men, but about the hard work that needs to be done every single day that allows people to live next to each other and understand that their humanness is equally as important as the person right next to them. And I know that seems sort of utopian, but, that's the goal here, is that to understand the humanity and create the empathy that is necessary.
I mean, the importance of that point is really not lost on us in this political time that
we're
in.
Yeah.
Right. So thank you. Thank you both for being here. Thanks for coming back, Jelaine Schmidt. And
thanks
for coming to the program, Andrea.
Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. So, Nancy, do you have a news of note to share?
I do. About said Trump administration, their latest senior national security hire comes from a bigoted conspiratorial organization that believes there's an ongoing secret Muslim plot to take over the United States. The man is Fred Flights. He's been named the executive secretary and chief of staff of the National Security Council. He was put in place by the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, who spent the last decade himself constantly pushing for war instead of diplomacy. Flights, in particular, served as the senior vice president for policy and programs for this place called the Center for Security Policy, which is known by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. He's a columnist for Fox News. He's written all sorts of glowing things about Trump. But the CSP, this place where he's come from, has spent years pushing this plot by the Muslim Brotherhood to infiltrate the U.S. and the government, warning us all of creeping Sharia, which is supposedly, you know, to enshrine the most extreme hardcore Islamic beliefs in America, completely made up, as I said, bigoted concepts, just as a rationale to demonize, you know, 3.3 million Muslims in America. And of course, Trump's view of the CSP is they're very highly respected people, which I know, actually. Anyway, his name is Fred Flights. I'm sure we will hear about his work.
Thank you for that. I shouldn't say thank you, but for bringing that to light. Yes.
Yeah.
And I have two short ones. John Brennan, I believe is his name. John Brennan is the former CIA director from 2013 to 17, wrote his first op-ed, and the title of it in the Washington Post is, "I Will Speak Out Until Integrity Returns to the White House." And he just writes a really sobering analysis of all, you know, his 3 decades of seeing the traits, what he calls the traits and tactics of corrupt, incompetent, and narcissistic foreign officials. He says who did whatever they thought was necessary to retain power. And he goes on and he says in the end, it never dawned on him that we could face that such a development in the United States. And then one other brief one, corrupt Scott Pruitt spent $1,500 of taxpayer money for 12 customized fountain pens. Each one was emblazoned with the seal of the EPA, which he's corrupting, and the signature of its leader. And the total order from this very prestigious fine jewelry DC store was $3,230, which also included personalized journals. Just add this to the tally.
Bucket list for that guy.
Yeah. So let's go to a break. And when we come back, we are going to be very excited. I'm happy to have Matthew Burtner here. He's Alaskan-born composer, sound artist, and inventor. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Apropos of Something. This is also 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We have Matthew Burtner here. He's our next guest. He's an award-winning, multifaceted inventor and composer and sound artist. He's born in Alaska, and he conveys social, spiritual, and political themes using technology and the environment to make unique and evocative soundscapes. His music is made from snow, cold, wind, and lava. Through his many projects, Burtner expresses his activism on behalf of the environment. He performs widely, creating expressive live concerts with immersive ritual sound art. He has a concert coming up this Friday, June 8th, which we'll talk about. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Hi, great to be here.
So, tell us about growing up in Alaska, how that influenced your music, and a little bit of your story.
Well, I was really fortunate to grow up in a unmediated way, that is, without television or the internet or really even electricity and water at times. My parents were creative people. They built their cabin, dug a well, you know, built furniture, clothing, and they imparted to me a kind of spirit of making things yourself and living in collaboration with the natural world, with what's around you. That impressed me very much and has affected the direction of my career. I am a composer. I create music, but it shares a lot of that spirit of creative engagement and indeed collaboration with the natural world. So I started, from making music, just performing music outside and just being aware of the sounds of the natural world and those kind of changing forces, I discovered that technology could help us, could help me connect my my musical compositional forms to the natural world. And so I studied computer music and music technology as a way of accessing these natural systems.
So what, Matthew, what are ecoacoustics?
Well, ecoacoustics are impressions of the changes in the environment, whether those are sonic or other types of energy change in the environment into the acoustic domain, and ultimately, in my case, into music. Eventually, ecoacoustic music is the application of ecoacoustics into musical forms. So, you know, these might be sounds like, you know, I've worked a lot with sounds from Alaska, like the snow and the ice and wind, but also they could be changes in things like temperature or the extent of ice. So through techniques of sonification, we can map data from one domain into the sound domain and understand that as a kind of changing acoustic and musical form.
How do you feel it translates into activism for you?
Well, for me, activism is about applying your work to the things you care about for change in the world, no matter what that is. Surprisingly, we don't do that to the extent that we could. People, that is, all of us, we tend to work on things that don't actually affect the things that we care about. And so trying to align one's work with one's, you know, ethics and ability to positively change the world is activism. And so, you know, I've worked on behalf of the environment and tried to have my music and my skills and as a composer apply to the things that I care about, that is sustainability and environmental preservation.
And speaking of that, I know your music wound up being featured by the State Department at a Glacier conference, and tell us how that happened and what did that sound like?
Yeah, so the Obama State Department was doing an event called Glacier, a conference in Alaska with Arctic leaders, and they were interested in having kind of background music for their event that was about the subjects they were talking about, change in the Arctic and how we can preserve the Arctic environment, which is changing, of course, you know, very rapidly, and had been changing more rapidly than other parts of the world. And so they asked me to create music that they could use kind of in select places throughout the event, throughout the conference. And so I put together I called them the Obama remixes in my computer, because they were basically pieces I had written before, mostly that I kind of tuned for the event. That is, you know, some of my music might have kind of explosive sounds, but we can't have, you know, explosive sounds happening in the, you know, in the background of the conference. So, you know, I would alter that. And then I composed a new piece for them that is coming out on a CD soon, an album that's a Threnody piece, Threnody Sikuikvik, that's made out of the sounds of an Alaskan glacier melting, and the sounds in particular of the air that's trapped in that glacier opening up into our atmosphere and creating a little tiny pop sound as this ancient atmosphere interacts with our atmosphere, and you hear this kind of field of popping sounds along with a sonification of glacier ice melt.
That's so interesting, the sound of ancient atmosphere colliding with our current atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so what, tell us about, it reminds me of a little bit that I read about Oxalac. Can you talk about that? One, National Geographic, one of their publications, said it was a cultural event that married science, the brain, art as the heart, and culture as the soul in our search for awareness and sustainability.
That was a very inspiring quote to me, that review, because it sort of reconfirmed my aspiration that the music may be part of could be part of the conversation and add something new to the dialogue on climate change. And so after that, I was pursuing particular opportunities where the music could engage with public discourse, with politics, such as the State Department event, with other fields, other disciplines, with science itself. And Oxalac is we called it an opera, a climate change opera. But by opera, you know, we really are thinking that it's a voice featuring piece of multimedia staged work. So it uses video, it uses various kinds of projections and singers. But in this opera, the musicians are spread all around the world on several different stages, and they are connected with high-speed internet so that audiences in the different locations can hear and see all of the groups together. And so we tried to create a global concert that would function as a forum on climate change, particularly focused on change in the Arctic, but the concept extrapolates very easily to change in that we all have observed in our home places as we've lived in this time of dramatic climate change.
And you invented, maybe not as close to Oxalac, but around that time you invented the Nomads telematic system and used it in this opera. So what is the Nomads telematic system?
Yeah, so one of the ideas with Oxalac is that the audience should not be just passively observing the piece, but rather should engage with the dialogue and bring their own ideas and imaginations for change into the composition itself. And so Nomads is a software that basically allows the audience to interact with the musical work in real time in various ways. So in Oxalac, they create the sound, they create layers of the sound, they create texts that the singers actually use to structure the melody. So several of the songs in the piece are melodies without words, and the singers just look at this screen, and as the texts come from the audience members around the world, they just draw words right out of that field of text and apply it to the melody. And so we hear the echoes of what the audience is thinking and inputting into the system applied to the music of Oxalac. It creates a really unusual kind of concert environment where the audience is kind of implicated and asked to engage with the issues on hand. We used it in Oxalac, and then it's been used in other ways as well, effectively.
That is so cool, Nomads. Are you going? What's your local your concert here on June 8th? Is it going to do any of that technology?
Yeah, so we're co-chairing a conference called NIME. It's the New Interfaces for Musical Expression Conference. It's being organized with Virginia Tech and the University of Virginia. It's the largest new instrument technology conference in the world. It's an international conference. And so a bunch of inventors are coming here, and we're giving a concert on June 8th at the Haven. And that'll feature, you know, all sorts of amazing instruments, like a robotic bagpipes and a fog instrument, a piece called Not Fog by one of our former students who's coming back for this. And we're creating a piece that we've been working on for the whole year, ever since the August 11th and August 12th, a kind of response to the Summer of Hate. We've been developing that, and it's a collaborative piece, and we'll be presenting that at that concert as well, using a number of new instruments and eco-acoustics as well.
And what time?
That's at 7:30 at the Haven, and it's free and open to everybody.
That's great. Again, we'll put it on the website, AOS Talk, that's a bit.ly link, or 947wpvc.org. We're talking to Matthew Burtner. He's the Alaskan-born composer, inventor, and multifaceted individual.
What is, considering it is so technologically based, what is your creative process? Even if it's not the same all the time, just I'd love a sense of how you create this stuff.
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. I don't quite know how to answer that. I think about sound and place and ideas, and then sounds come, and I work on the on kind of unpacking them. I don't have a very good answer for that, but I do believe that artists can gain inspiration from being outside, being in the field. So I part of my creative process is to get out of the studio, actually, to be in sites and spend time there, not necessarily doing experiments or field recordings, but sometimes just, you know, going on a walk or just sitting there, just being in the place. And having that interplay between the studio work and the field work is a big part of my creative process.
Let's see how good a question this one is, then. Is how do you teach this kind of music? Because I know you're a teacher at UVA as well.
Yeah, so I teach a courses in ecoacoustics, music technology, and composition. And it's kind of about combining the technological skill sets and approaches with creative thinking, problem solving, and experimentation with environmental sciences, and trying to create a convergence of those things around the subjects that the students are interested in. So again, it's all about turning the work that we do back onto the things that we care about. And the things that I care about might be different, will be different from the things that the students care about, but trying to create this machine for activism through creative engagement with the world.
So I wanted to mention your website. I haven't done that yet. It is MatthewBurtner.com. That's B-U-R-T-N-E-R, MatthewBurtner.com. There's a lot of great stuff there, including this Metasax thing. I don't know what it is. Instrument that you invented. Can you tell us just briefly what that is?
Yeah, sure. The Metasax, it's an older instrument now, but it's, you know, one of the kind of early, what we would call an augmented musical instrument. It's a saxophone that's been retrofitted with a onboard microprocessor, an array of sensors that converts the input from the performer into a computer control signal. So you couple the acoustic saxophone with the computer to create new kinds of new modes of performance for this instrument. And it was actually, this instrument was presented at the very first New Interfaces for Musical Expression conference back in 2002. And so it's really interesting to be bringing that whole international conference here to Virginia these many years later. Saxophone was the instrument that I started on, and it's still something that I play regularly and often develop my ideas on saxophone. And so having that kind of interface directly to the computer has been really helpful for example, letting the saxophonist play the wind. So using physical models of environmental systems that then the performer can directly interact with.
Hey, Nance.
And the I did want to ask, because I know that activism is such an important component of your music. You established EcoSono, and tell us what that mission is.
Yeah, EcoSono is a platform for music, for creating music for environmental sustainability. So trying to apply ecoacoustics in the world outside of the academy. And so EcoSono is a global nonprofit organization with you know, different centers. And we do a lot of work in Alaska. We have a festival in Anchorage, for example. We have a program in Colorado. We've toured around, worked a lot with Australia. And so this is a group that's kind of, functioning more on the public, engagement, angle, but using the kind of foundational work of the research that we're doing in the university.
So we're going to have to say goodbye, unfortunately. I don't know. Please come back. We can finish the discussion. And I'm going to ask you a question. We're going to put it on the website, but don't answer it now. How do you record snow? How do you record air? How do you record cold? So we'll put that on the website.
And Nancy, homework.
Yes,
LNC
thank you.
Homework in the summer.
So
thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Matthew Bertner.
Yeah.
It's time for the palate cleanser. We have no time left.
Palate cleansers. I had no idea we had time, but I don't want to talk the time up. All right, do we really have time, Ellen, or should we?
Not really.
No, okay. Because I don't want to waste mine.
I know. Let's do it another time. I don't want to be rude to the next show that's coming up. But thank you, everybody. Our music, our theme music is by Spring Tide from Japan. We want to thank our guests, Andrea Douglas, Jelaine Schmidt, and, of course, Matthew Bertner. No one has to do everything, but everyone needs to do something, especially these days. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. Bye, Nance.
Yeah. See you, Ellen.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.